Today we have 5 cases on the docket. 3 will be heard orally and 2 are submitted on the briefs. For the record, the 2 cases submitted on the briefs are 06-5104, Acevedo versus the U.S., and 06-3414, Chambers versus Interior. First case to be argued is 04-1440, Integris versus Gulf Corporation. Ready, counsel?
Yes.
I'm sure you're familiar with the lighting system.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. I'm Mike Hoffman. With me is Mr. Lowell, also the lighting board, the mayor, and the firm. May please the court. This case concerns a precipitously entered preliminary injunction that, despite the subsequent dissolution, continues to cause real injury to my client, Gulf Corporation.
Counsel, you're not appealing, though, the grant of the preliminary injunction. You had an opportunity to do that, right?
And we did, Your Honor.
But then you withdrew the appeal.
We withdrew the appeal when the injunction was dissolved, but the contempt order issued, and we immediately changed it to the appeal from the contempt order.
So you're not appealing the grant of the injunction?
Not anymore. Not the grant, only the lingering effects of the injunction, namely the contempt portion. Our position is that the injunction, the effects of the injunction, really have not stopped. They continue today, and they continue to cause real harm.
And so why
are the contempt findings appealable at this juncture?
At this juncture, Your Honor, because they are connected to, they are ancillary to, as a number of courts have said, the appeal from the underlying injunction. We have presently appeals from the injunction itself.
But you're not impacted by the underlying injunction, are you?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. We are by the contempt citation that continues to be out there.
But is the contempt final?
The contempt is a final order under this court's and other courts' decisions, yes, absolutely.
Can't you appeal that along with the merits?
One could appeal it, but I believe the statute, as it has been construed by every court that we have been able to find, has said that we're entitled to an interlocutory appeal. And that is precisely because of the impact, I believe, that preliminary injunctions, particularly when they are in the end, and when they turn out in the end to be ill-considered, were entered in error.
But it was...
Counsel, I'm confused. Are you saying you're appealing this and that the court has jurisdiction because it's an interlocutory appeal or because it's a final judgment?
Both, Your Honor. There's a special rule for contempt judgments that arise from interlocutory or preliminary injunctions.
You're talking about 1292, I assume,
I'm talking
correct?
About 1292C as well as 1295, I believe.
1295 is final judgment. 1292 is interlocutory. So let's go through them in order.
Sure.
1292 on interlocutory, which section of that statute are you saying gives you a right to appeal?
1292C that refers to the grant or refusal to grant or modification of an injunction. We believe, first of all, that even the appellee's pendency of the appeal from the dissolution is sufficient jurisdiction for adjudication of the contempt proceeding.
The injunction was dissolved, so it's no longer in existence.
But the appeal was taken even by Microlis or Integris. I'll use the term Microlis. The appeal was taken from the dissolution of the injunction. That is one of the provisions of 1292.
But that's their cross-appeal. You're not relying on their cross-appeal for jurisdiction on the dissolution of the injunction,
no,
right?
Sure. I can rely on that, or I can rely, and this is what I'm relying on as well, I'm relying on the de facto modification of the preliminary injunction.
There was no modification. It was dissolved.
No, there was a modification, Your Honor, because during the pendency of the injunction, the injunction was modified to cover additional products, which the court, the district court, had distinguished over in order to render these claims not invalid or not likely invalid.
But the injunction was not modified to cover those products. As I understand it, the injunction was simply read to cover those products.
And under SACO, under the case from this court, SACO, that is a de facto modification of an injunction. The contempt order was broadened, Your Honor, to
to take in product that was clearly excluded, that was not mentioned in the injunction.
What the injunction said, the EDZ-2, I might be getting it not exactly right, or colorable imitation thereof, and the district court found very clearly this was a colorable imitation thereof and explicitly was not modifying the injunction.
Right. That is a finding that the district court made. I don't believe the district court actually made the finding that the EZD-3 was a colorable imitation. It did so, if you will, by assessing a penalty against Paul and in favor of Integris or Micros. There are two. There's an EZD-3 that is slotted. I believe that is where the court held it was insufficiently different. And then there's an EZD-3 system that has no slot.
But the slotless one, the court found that there was no infringement.
Here's the quote, counsel. The district court says, I conclude the differences between the original EZD-2 and both the redesigned EZD-2 and EZD-3 with the slot are too insubstantial to avoid violation of the injunction.
Right.
If they're talking about violating the injunction, they're not talking about a new modified injunction or a new injunction. They're saying that these two new products violate the actual injunction that's already in place.
That's right.
So how is that a modification?
Well, it is a modification because the change that was made, Your Honor, took away a key aspect of the invention as the trial judge had termed it. In other words, the automatic alignment. The trial judge had said the automatic alignment feature in these systems, the automatic alignment was to be read into the claims, and it is what distinguished it over otherwise anticipatory prior art. When that occurred, Paul took out the aligning feature. Paul sold systems in which these filters no longer mated with the slot on the bottom. There's a slot here that fits into this and aligns. That was removed, that was taken out, so all alignment now was manual. No more, there's no tab here. It can rotate. It is no more automatically aligning.
But isn't that the
case is on all fours with Seiko.
But counsel, isn't all that really part of the slotless EZ3? That's the slotless one that the court said did not infringe. And
no, it's not, Your Honor, because even with the slot even being here, there's no longer any component on the filter that can engage the slot. So you cannot have any aligning. I mean, for aligning, you need the cooperation of two pieces. One piece has to fit inside the other piece. We no longer have a tab on the bottom of the filter that fits into anything. So it is impossible for this slot to do any aligning. So that is our first position. The next position is, Your Honor, that with the falling of the injunction, the law is absolutely clear. With the dissolution of the injunction, the contempt had to fall. There is no case that we've been able to find, and every case has been to the contrary. All the way up and down the line, Supreme Court on down, United Mine Workers, that when the injunction falls, the contempt must fall. As a matter of law, and some courts have said that that, in fact, supports the exercise of jurisdiction on appeal.
Well, this is distinguishable from those cases where a court may have been in possession of information, for example, that it only later discovers is relevant to the injunction and therefore warrants vacatur of the injunction. And in those circumstances, the court, in effect, dissolved the contempt, concluding that it is inappropriate, unfair, if you will, to hold someone in contempt of an order that perhaps should not have been issued in the first place. But this is a little different because the basis for the vacatur was the discovery of information, the newly discovered references that weren't present before.
That's correct.
So and therefore what you have is a circumstance where the injunction is vacated based on new information not present at the time the injunction was initially granted, and you have a party that has been found to be in contempt of the order as it stood during the period in which the conduct was taking place. And it doesn't necessarily follow from the previous cases that the vacatur of the injunction under these circumstances should automatically nullify the contempt.
Perhaps respectfully, we disagree. I'm not aware of any cases or any law that draws a distinction on the basis that Judge Lynn, you just indicated. I think even in the cases in which it turns out later on that jurisdiction was not vested in the district court that issued the preliminary injunction, even in those cases, there was usually some after-acquired information that came to light that then was employed in a motion to dismiss or whatever, in a motion that essentially rendered divested the court of jurisdiction, let's say. That is also after acquired information. What happened in this case, Your Honor, is that the claim construction employed during the preliminary injunction proceedings was sort of an ever-changing thing. And so after all of a sudden this alignment became such a significant thing, of course, that was a claim construction that was employed. We went back and found some prior art showing alignment. So, it is not a matter of sort of having sat on evidence and then being late. In other words, I don't think my client can be charged with any neglect in bringing the evidence forth in the first place. But be that as it may, that is not disposable of this issue. Under all of the law, when the injunction falls, the contempt decree cannot stand. In United Mine Workers, the Supreme Court addressed the balance between the fairness, the unjust compensation to the person who received the unwarranted contempt, or the reward, if you will, from the unwarranted contempt decree.
But why was the contempt decree unwarranted if, in fact, the three items that the court reviewed were, in fact, infringing items?
It was unwarranted, Your Honor, because the patents were likely not valid and are likely not valid. That's what the court said. A and B, we say there was also no infringement, but that's what we said. The court said.
The court said, as noted above, have determined the slotless EZD-3 manifolds raise standard substantial questions concerning infringement.
Right, that in addition.
Right.
I also conclude,
however, that the Japanese references presented in connection with Paul's motion to dissolve raise substantial questions about the validity of the patents, the microlist patents. However, that does not mean that you were not in violation of the PI at the time that it was issued with the three previous elements.
I agree, Your Honor. I don't disagree that the court held that Paul was in violation of the injunction. I agree with you. I don't deny that. That is what the court held. It just turns out that it should have not entered the injunction in the first place. And it's not the district court's fault. It's simply that the timing and the claims were changing, and the new prior art, in light of the changed claims, came to light. We brought it to the court's attention, and the court said, oops, I shouldn't have entered the injunction, I guess. This is the problem with rushing in with preliminary injunction requests on imperfect records, on undeveloped records.
Well, usually a PI is really asked for right at the beginning when you file a complaint. So that's the standard operating procedure.
Okay, that's right. But that is a problem with that process. It is on an imperfect record. It doesn't give the defendant a chance many times. We don't have the claim construction in place. And so it is not, I suppose, uncommon or not unexpectable that one might find that an injunction, a preliminary injunction rushed into might turn out to be not warranted.
Would it make any difference if the court had issued two separate orders, one the contempt order, completed that, and then subsequently issued the violation, the dissolution of the PI? And
I don't know. It would have made a difference if the other way around. Yeah, it would have made a difference if the court had dissolved the injunction and then perhaps asked for an order to show cause for why the contempt should not be dissolved or why the contempt should be entered. I mean, remember, the court stopped the preliminary injunction and then immediately, at the same time, entered the contempt decree. Instead of asking for an order to show cause, well, we could have breached it. We never were given that opportunity. Paul was never given that opportunity.
You rely on SECO, right? Our decision on SECO.
Yes.
Does that mean that we have jurisdiction to determine under Federal Circuit law whether or not we have jurisdiction over the contempt order, or is it regional circuit law?
I believe it's federal circuit law.
Why?
Because of what Judge Newman said at Staco. I think there's a general rule that courts have, if you will, ancillary appellate jurisdiction. This court has exercised it in at least two cases. Staco is one. The other one was Katz, Your Honor. The Katz case where this court decided, I believe it was a joinder case, to take up a joinder issue in connection with a preliminary injunction appeal all at the same time. It is done for reasons of judicial economy. But in this case, I believe the jurisdiction is more than just discretionary. I think there's jurisdiction that arises under 1292 with respect to the...
Counsel, you keep going back to 1292 and saying it's interlocutory, but I don't see any section of 1292 that gives jurisdiction over a contempt proceeding. And then you rely on Staco, which seems to suggest that maybe it's not interlocutory, but rather a final decree, and that's why. So these are two completely different rationales for why you think you might have jurisdiction. My problem with Staco is it seems to directly conflict with two previous Supreme Court decisions, Doyle and Fox. And in Doyle, the Supreme Court say, we deem it settled that an order punishing for contempt made in the progress of a case, when not in the nature of an order in a criminal proceeding, is regarded as interlocutory and to be reviewed only upon appeal from a final decree in the case. And that case seems to be on all fours with this one, as does the Fox decision, so it makes it very difficult for me to ascertain how we ought to conclude that this is a final order in this case, when we have two Supreme Court precedents that seem to me on all fours.
Well, there's a Supreme Court precedent of the United Mine Workers case, which says that there's jurisdiction and that a contempt decree cannot stand with a preliminary injunction. And there's, of course, the Katz v. Lear case, and there's the Staco case. If this court is going to overrule Staco, then that is obviously something that this court can consider. I don't know what to say about that, but we believe that in Staco, the same thing happened that happened here. These ink cartridges that were enjoined were all of a sudden expanded, or the group of enjoined product was expanded, and there was a contempt order issued regarding the expanded product.
But counsel, there's one important factual difference from Staco. In Staco, they actually did appeal. In that appeal, the granting of the injunction. You all waived that. You didn't appeal.
We appealed the injunction.
And then you dismissed your own appeal.
Yes, because we said it was moot.
Okay.
It was moot.
So in this particular appeal, there is no appeal of the underlying grant of the injunction. In Staco, there was both. The appeal of the underlying injunction, which clearly gives the court jurisdiction, and the contempt, which was inextricably combined with the appeal of the underlying injunction.
And
those are different facts than are present here.
But the answer I have is this. Under the circumstances of due posture, Your Honor, a party would have no appeal at all in the situation that arose here.
At the end of the case.
But in the meantime, the damage to my client's reputation goes on. The whispering campaign about the contempt order goes on. There's real damage now, and this is why there's an interlocutory review from a preliminary injunction. Because I think Congress recognized that there was some severe impact of that, and that it ought to be reviewable. And in this case, you would take away any remedy, any review of this interlocutory, this rushed judgment. And that's the problem with what we find. You see, there's no precedent. I have found not a single case where an injunction was dissolved and a contempt order was left in place. There's not a single such instance. And there's a reason for that. The Supreme Court doesn't allow it. United Mine Worker doesn't allow it.
Thank you, counsel. We'll restore 3 minutes of your rebuttal time. Mr. Montgomery?
May it please the court. With me at the counsel table is DeRulo Lindley.
We'll add some time to your presentation if it's necessary.
Thank you. Integris will not object if the court concludes that there is no jurisdiction over the appeal on the contempt. Having said that, however, we agree with Mr. Hartman that there is jurisdiction, but for a slightly different reason. We certainly don't agree that there was a modification of the injunction for the reasons that Judge Lane stated, but we do think that 1292A1 and the appellate jurisdiction conferred by that statute are broad enough to govern this particular appeal, under the view taken by, I think, every other circuit that has looked at it, because the appeal on the contempt actually involves consideration of aspects of the ruling on the contempt, because of this argument that they make, with which we don't agree, about the implications of dissolution. So we think that is sufficient.
I'm confused, though, counsel. Under 1292A1, can you point me to exactly which language? Because we only have jurisdiction over what Congress grants us jurisdiction over. We can't make it up no matter how compelling, you know, a policy argument might be. So what exact language of 1292A1 do you think confers jurisdiction on this court?
It requires, Your Honor, that you apply the sense of other circuits that where a contempt order is the subject of an appeal that relates to, is integrally part of, a preliminary injunction. Whether or not the injunction is appealed from, the court has jurisdiction. And I don't believe, for example, that in SACO, that there was an appeal from the grant of the preliminary injunction. So I don't think it's been critical in a number of cases.
But, counsel, I need you to show me in the statute where we have jurisdiction, because I can't find it. The statute says granting. Well, this is not an appeal from a grant of an injunction. How about continuing? Are you suggesting that this is the continuance of an injunction?
Not at all. And I am referring
modifying?
To,
no?
Your Honor,
refusing?
I am referring to the dissolving injunctions portion of the statute. But, of course, I concede that this particular appeal does not itself involve dissolution of the injunction, but they do present to you the implications of the dissolution of the injunction, because Mr. Hartman argues that if the injunction is dissolved, that the contempt cannot stand. It is that linkage that we think is sufficient under 1292, but as I said, I certainly am not going to object if you find there is no jurisdiction at all.
Well, under Fox, though, let's go back to the Supreme Court case. Fox v. Capital Corporation. That specifically states that the rule is settled in this court that except in connection with an appeal from a final judgment or decree, a party to a suit may not review upon appeal in order of finding or imprisoning him for the commission of a civil contempt. So what does that mean? What does that language mean to us? What instructions?
Your Honor, if you apply that language from Fox exactly as stated, without considering the issues that the arguments that are presented here by Mr. Hartman, one would have to conclude that there is no jurisdiction. What we're suggesting is that because there's a sufficient relationship between the injunction and the contempt, that most courts have concluded that there are sufficient equities, considerations of justice, that make it sensible for the courts of appeals to grant jurisdiction.
But the injunction has been dissolved.
The appeal
on the injunction has been mooted out. They withdrew that appeal.
Correct.
The only appeal before us is on the issue of contempt.
Correct.
And it's not final. There's always the opportunity to bring that up on the merits appeal.
They absolutely have that opportunity. But, of course, some courts have said that a contempt order is final when the remedy is final. And the remedy in this particular case is final. It is done.
But in the Fox case, there was a $250 fine. The $250 fine was a sanction. It was imposed. There were no contingencies, no ability to purge, nothing else. So that remedy was final in the Fox case. Yet the Supreme Court went on to hold that it was unappealable. It was not a final decree. It was an interlocutory. Okay.
Well, and I absolutely concede that the circumstance here in which an injunction has been dissolved below is a configuration of issues that I don't believe that we have seen in any prior case. Though, as I said, I think that the principles could support jurisdiction being exercised by a court. But I can't provide to you a citation from another court of appeals or from the Supreme Court that nails the issue.
Mr. Montgomery, hypothetically, if we find that there is no jurisdiction over the contempt appeal, Does that mean that the cross appeal falls too?
Not at all, because the cross appeal has an independent basis for jurisdiction itself in 12.92A1 because it involves the dissolution of the injunction. So on the language that Judge Moore was just reading, you do have jurisdiction. There is no linkage between our appeal and the appeal to the contempt.
So are you appealing the denial of a preliminary injunction?
We're appealing the dissolution of the preliminary injunction.
Now, is that a denial? Should we treat that like a denial of a preliminary injunction?
No, I think you should treat it like the dissolution of a preliminary injunction. It is, obviously, Your Honor, closely akin to the denial of a preliminary injunction, but particularly on this record, it rests on a base involving a determination by Judge O'Toole, not challenged, that a preliminary injunction was appropriate in the first place. And I think that's an absolutely critical aspect of the record for moving.
But it's now dissolved. Did you continue your request for a preliminary injunction based on the slotless item?
Well, the slotless EZD2 is not an issue in the appeal that you have.
Well, it's an EZD3, right?
That is not before you.
That's the subject of another case.
It's the subject of two other cases below. But the preliminary injunction, the contempt that was assessed was on the basis of the original EZD-2 and modifications that were made prior to the hearing on the contempt, not the EZD-3 slotless, which was actually introduced after that hearing.
Can you come here, Chris?
As I understand it, you noticed your appeal from the dissolution of the injunction on the same day, I believe, as the appellant noticed appeal from the contempt order, correct?
We did.
And that was within the normal 30-day period, I think, for noticing appeal. So as I understand it, your appeal and the appellant's appeal really independently stand on the same footing, and only by chance, because of the fact that the earlier notice of appeal that has now been withdrawn was filed first, you were styled as a cross appellant. Otherwise, you could have very well been an appellant. So in terms of jurisdiction, the jurisdiction for your appeal seems to me is independent and stands regardless of our determination of the jurisdiction of the appeal.
That is our view. And before I go to our appeal, let me just say, with respect to the contempt, that assuming you find jurisdiction, we think you need to go no further than the issue of waiver. And it's clear that the appeal here that's been lodged by Paul plainly has been waived. And you need only look at the LEA Dynatech case, upon which, ironically, Paul rests the decision of this court, articulating the circumstances under which you will address an issue in appeal which hasn't been presented to the district court. Here, you've got no pure question of law that would result in some miscarriage of justice if you didn't address it. There was no question of general impact that affects the public interest if you don't address this contempt issue. And they have had a full opportunity to raise this below. Mr. Hartman talks about timing considerations, but in fact there was absolutely nothing to preclude Paul, either at the time that they made the motion to dissolve or at the time that Judge O'Toole issued his contempt ruling, that they could not have brought their view to his attention that a dissolution would undermine the validity of the contempt order. They could have done that at either of those occasions by way of just pointing it out to him. They could have done it afterwards by a motion for reconsideration. They didn't do it, and therefore they have waived. And you have got no consideration of this issue from Judge O'Toole to review.
Mr. Montgomery, with respect to your cross appeal, are you also appealing the determination of non-infringement of the EZD-3, the slotless EZD-3?
We are not.
You're only appealing the validity. Discussion was in Judge O'Toole's determination and order.
No, our appeal doesn't touch the EZD-3 slotless at all. but only the EZD2 modified and the EZD, which I think subsequently was changed to the EZD3 with the slot. So we only get as far as the slotted EZD3 for purposes of this appeal.
But the representation that was made to the court below was the fact that they're no longer manufacturing that.
That is true. They have made that representation. Our view is that the injunction was well-founded at the time that it was entered, that they haven't presented a basis that justifies its dissolution, and that we're entitled to injunctive relief to preclude them from selling the original EZD2 or any of the modified devices up to the EZD3 slotless. And that is the basis for our appeal. That's the reason.
You don't read the court's order as basing the dissolution on the fact that the conduct was discontinued. You read the dissolution as being based upon the newly presented Sumitomo references, correct?
We do. We fully view that as the basis for Judge O'Toole's action. Having said that, Judgment, we recognize that the judge did, at the end of his opinion, mention the EZD3. But we think what he had in mind is simply a placeholder that the EZD3 would, in subsequent proceedings, have to be addressed in light of these new references that Paul had presented to them, which led Judge O'Toole to dissolve the injunction. But if you look at his reasoning, though we think it is not fully developed, his reasoning for dissolution of the injunction does not speak to the EZD3 slotless. Indeed, it actually focuses on issues of alignment, as to which Paul says, there is no issue presented on the slotless EZD3.
So, Mr. Montgomery, you're saying we should disregard Judge O'Toole's statement that Paul has presented it's currently distributing only slotless EZD3 standalone manifolds. I have determined that slotless EZD3 manifolds raise substantial questions concerning infringement. Right?
Correct.
So we should disregard that.
Well, I'm not asking you to disregard it. I'm asking you to put it in context. It is one of a line of products that were the subject of the multiple proceedings that Judge O'Toole had. The EZD slotless was only before him in the very last hearing. It actually wasn't before him at the time that he heard the contempt. Though I think you could view these proceedings together. But in any event, it wasn't before him. And his decision, the portion of his decision that we're appealing from, relates to the prior versions of the EZD2 and the EZD3.
Counsel, there are two things that I think support what you're arguing, although you haven't mentioned them. And just correct me or let me know if I'm just missing the boat here. The first would be, I would think, that it wouldn't make a lot of sense to me to see a district court dissolve a preliminary injunction in the middle of a proceeding, because couldn't they then always go back to making the EDZ-2 and the EDZ-3 slotted at any point in time? I mean, just on the basis that we have a new design, doesn't seem to me to be a grounds to dissolve the injunction, and in fact, if the injunction isn't hurting them, why would the court dissolve it at that point? So that was sort of my first thought, was that it didn't seem to me the court could be basing the dissolution on the fact that EDZ3 slotless might not infringe.
Well, that makes sense to me.
Well, the second thing I thought about when I was thinking about this was that I looked back at all the briefing, and in all the briefing related to the dissolution, every time the infringement of EDZ3 slotless was argued, it was in the context of irreparable harm. And so then it started to make sense to me that what the judge might have been saying when he was issuing his opinion was, there's these questions related to validity, and he clearly focused on that. And then there's also questions related to infringement, which might, because they're not continuing to manufacture the other products, and the one they are manufacturing doesn't likely infringe, that could go to irreparable harm, although his opinion may not have been so clear as to say that. That seemed to me the only way in which it was argued below. I saw never in any of the briefing did I see an allegation that the preliminary injunction should be dissolved on the basis of the slotless EZV3 not infringing. Is that correct?
And I think that's the result of time. Because at the time we were arguing contempt, there was no EZV3 slotless. And I think that's the reason.
Okay.
The slot or the slotless?
slotless. And it's only, the slotless only comes up subsequent to the hearing and the contempt and the motion that Paul makes to dissolve the injunction and that of the summa tomo references. And I think that is why the judge focuses in the bulk of his analysis on whether the summa tomo references anticipate the 907 or whether the 770 is obvious in light of those references. Because the focus there is on alignment. And alignment is not an issue that was argued to him in relation to the slotless EZB.
So going back to my original question, Mr. Montgomery, what you're really appealing is the denial of a preliminary injunction. That's the essence of your appeal, isn't it?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because we had a preliminary injunction. It's the loss of that injunction. We are not seeking an injunction that would extend to the EZB through slotless. We're trying to preserve or secure again the injunction that we had that applied to the other devices. So I don't think I could accede to your formulation. And it would appear that I, like Mr. Hartman, am well out of time.
You can have two more minutes if you want to discuss it, because we gave Mr. Hartman some time.
If I may say that for rebuttal, I would appreciate that.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hartman, you have 3 minutes.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. There are only a couple of points I'd like to make. Going back to Section 1292, clearly dissolving the injunction is one of the events that triggers jurisdiction in this court. No question about that. The other point I'd like to make is that if indeed Paul were deemed to have dropped, completely withdrawn its appeal 1440, the first filed appeal from the injunction, that was filed within 30 days after entry of the injunction, then Paul stands here as a cross appellant because its appeal was filed after, same day, but after Michaelis's appeal was filed. Michaelis's appeal is the 65 number, the 1265 number. Paul's appeal is 1266. That would, seems to me, make Paul the cross appellant here. So even there, under the law, now you have an injunction, a preliminary injunction, the dissolution of which is being appealed, and certainly the contempt order would seem to be an appropriate subject matter of the appeal under all of the law of all of the circuits.
Under what law, counsel? You keep saying all the law of all the circuits, but just switching the nature of the parties from appeal to cross appeal, it doesn't make a difference.
I agree with you. My point is that these two matters, the appeal from the dissolution of the injunction, puts the preliminary injunction issue squarely before this court, and with it come the ancillary, so-called ancillary issues, such as contempt.
Are you talking about Clinton v. Jones, the Supreme Court's case, which talks about when there can be pendant jurisdiction over something over which there might not otherwise be?
Yes, I'm talking about that. Okay. But I'm talking beyond that about this whole doctrine of sanctions based on preliminary injunctions being reviewable with the review relating to the preliminary injunction. There's a solid body of law. I don't believe I've seen one case to the contrary that states that the general principle that contempt judgments are reviewable with a review relating to the injunction, the preliminary injunction.
Other than Seiko Epson, what case do you rely on?
Your Honor, there are a number of cases. I will refer, first of all, Seiko can't be near the other case in which this court, the Federal Circuit, considered a question relating to joinder in connection with the appeal of a preliminary injunction. Relating to joinder. That's a 1990 case, 909 F. 2nd, 1459. The other cases are the Ringsat case by our Judge Posner in Chicago. It says all courts to consider the issue have held that the underlying order is appealable as civil contempt judgment designed to enforce it is appealable at the same time. Latrobe, 1976, 545 F. 2nd, 1336. It is well established that an appellate court may consider the matter of civil contempt in connection with an appeal from the underlying preliminary injunction. Diamantini v. Borg, the Ninth Circuit case, 918 F. 2nd, 793.
the preliminary injunction appeal from a refusal to find contempt held incident to and hence appealable with the defendant's appeal from the preliminary injunction. So there, the refusal to enter a contempt order was appealable, along with the preliminary injunction matter. Polnar versus Decade, the Second Circuit case, says appeal from a contempt order is ancillary to the appeal from the preliminary injunction. So my point simply is, if the preliminary injunction, the dissolution, the granting, is before this court, the modification, then with it comes jurisdiction over the contempt.
Mr. Hartman, I think we have your argument. Thank you very much. Mr. McConnell?
I have nothing further on Paul's contempt, so if I were going to use this in a minute or two, it would have to be on our own appeal. With your indulgence, I'll spend a couple minutes on that, or I can just
sit down. Well, I think that we have it pretty well understood.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Montgomery. Case is submitted.